This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. To hunt or not to hunt? That is the question on wildlife officials' minds moving forward with a plan to allow the first ever alligator hunting season in North Carolina. The State Wildlife Resources Commission has proposed rules that call for a 30-day season in the fall. Wildlife Diversity Coordinator Alan Boynton says they're seeking public comment on the plan now through January 25th.
We have had requests from a number of people interested in hunting alligators. South Carolina recently started an alligator season, and after that happened, the requests that we received increased.
South Carolina's alligator hunting season started in 2008. Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Texas all allow alligator hunting, making North Carolina the only state in the alligator's range which does not allow hunting. Boynton says the season would likely run from September 1st through October 1st.
No firearms would be allowed to be used to hunt alligators, but could be used to dispatch the animal once it's restrained. The legal methods of harvest would include catch poles, harpoons, gigs, clubs, bang sticks, and archery equipment. The proposal is to allow people to use artificial lights as well.
The Wildlife Resources Commission is proposing a take of one alligator per season with a permit. Kimberly Williams, co-owner of Eastern Carolina Taxidermy in Smithfield, says her clientele is interested in alligator hunting.
I would say 80-95% at least. Why go to another state and pay another state to be able to do it when you can do it in North Carolina and it can benefit our state?
Williams says she's glad to hear about the plan.
It's a wonderful sport. Everybody here has done it. We went to South Carolina to do it.
In addition to generating revenue through hunting permits, an alligator season could also be a tourism draw for people coming from other states. However, the proposal is drawing criticism from some. The reason? The American alligator is listed as a threatened species. Director of the North Carolina offices of the Southern Environmental Law Center, Derb Carter.
Well, it is ironic that we consider it to be threatened, which is one step from endangered, but potentially allowing hunting. And we hope the Wildlife Commission gives that serious consideration.
The American alligator was almost extinct in the United States during the 1950s due to overhunting and habitat loss. The species was listed as federally endangered in 1967, and after 20 years, their populations rebounded. Still, alligators remain a protected species because they look similar to crocodiles. In Gates County, on the Virginia border, the northernmost established population of about five alligators live at Merchants Mill Pond State Park.
North Carolina is just a bit different. Being at the far northern end of the range, we really don't have that many alligators.
The majority of the state's alligators are in southeastern North Carolina. Carter says a recent study conducted by the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission and North Carolina State University assessed the status and population of alligators in the state.
The study was conducted over a two-year period and reported back to the commission that alligator populations in North Carolina are stable or perhaps slightly increasing.
The study's findings were presented to the Wildlife Resources Commission on March 5, 2015, by NC State University's Dr. Chris Moorman. The report found that while alligators were plentiful in the southeastern part of the state, any harvest of adult alligators is not sustainable. The WRC announced the hunting proposal anyway, since federal provisions in place allow states to choose whether or not to allow an alligator hunting season. Approval from the Non-Game Wildlife Advisory Committee is not needed before alligator hunting can be allowed. Wildlife Diversity Coordinator Alan Boynton says stabilizing populations of alligators is the main reason for proposing the hunting season.
So hunting is managed in such a way as to maintain populations which have recovered largely from the low point that they once were.
While some feel that allowing hunting would only decrease an already threatened species, others, like taxidermist Kimberly Williams, say alligator hunting would actually allow wildlife officials to track gator populations more closely, which could bolster their numbers further.
The money that we pay for hunting goes for conservation as well. If there's not a market or a need for an animal, that's one of the main reasons that they go extinct, and there's not anyone to actually speak for them. And hunters love animals as much or better than any person you'll ever find. Trust me. I know a lot of people just don't understand hunting, but, you know, I have to say it's one of the, it is the main conservation society that we have.
The North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission is collecting public comments on the alligator hunting proposal from now until January 25th. You can submit online comments or attend a public meeting planned Tuesday, January 5th at Bladen Community College in Dublin, Tuesday, January 19th at Swain Auditorium in Edenton, and Wednesday, January 20th at Craven Community College in New Bern. Wildlife Diversity Coordinator Alan Boynton says they'll use the public's feedback to hammer out the details of the proposal.
We have not talked about specifics of the program yet. We're interested in public comment, and then if the commission were to adopt the proposal to establish a alligator season, we would make a decision about where and how many permits would be issued.
Once all of the hearings have been conducted and comments have been reviewed, the commission will meet in February to make a decision on whether or not to establish an alligator season. If approved, the first hunting season would be open in August 2016. Wellness organizations in eastern North Carolina are trying to break the stigmas associated with mental disorders and substance abuse. They've launched a pilot program with two screening kiosks in Hyde and Dare counties to help people identify behavioral issues and connect with resources. Sarah Finch has more on these interactive booths and a new computer program that may know you better than you know yourself.
Taking care of your health means paying attention to your body and your mind. Yet in today's society, behavioral issues are considered a touchy subject. Mental health disorders ranging from depression to PTSD are common both nationally and locally, but they're not always addressed and treated in a timely manner. For Eastern North Carolina, this is especially true. Trillium Health Resources Clinical Operations Vice President Cindy Ellers says it's because ENC encompasses so many rural areas.
Mental health is not any more prevalent in Eastern North Carolina than anywhere else in the United States. A lot of the opportunities that may exist in larger, more urban areas don't exist in Eastern North Carolina because there are less people, and that can make getting treatment for some issues a lot more challenging.
Trillium Health Resources doesn't provide direct care. Rather, they connect individuals and families to resources in their own communities. As a local governmental agency, Trillium Health Resources manages mental health, substance use, and disability services throughout 24 Eastern North Carolina counties. Trillium's response to the stigma of mental health disorders was to install two wellness booths at the Hyde County Government Center and the Dare County Department of Public Health building. They created a computer program that screens people by asking detailed questions and then referring them to local treatment centers. Trillium Health Resources Project Coordinator Bobby Lowe likens the technology to drugstore diagnostic machines.
Lots of people have done the blood pressure kiosk at their local drugstore. They might not have called it a kiosk, but people know what that is when you talk about it. This is exactly like that. It's just looking for mental health or addiction issues.
The wheelchair accessible kiosk is like a small cubicle with a touchscreen computer plus both English and Spanish language options.
The kiosk is 100% free. It asks a few demographic questions, and then it actually goes through the screening questions for the specific issue they're being screened for. They're not cumbersome or difficult to navigate.
The first step identifies how the subject has been thinking or behaving. The Access Point program then asks questions about how you're feeling. After 10 to 15 minutes, a comprehensive report about your moods and behaviors is displayed on screen. Vice President Cindy Ellers says these screenings are educational, not diagnostic.
It screens and tells you that you seem to have enough of the symptoms that you really need to get an appointment to have an assessment done and get treatment. And then it tells you exactly how to do that. So it doesn't actually give you a diagnosis, but it does give you an indication that you're hitting enough of the criteria or that you're not.
The Access Point program also connects users to resources, including treatment recommendations, referrals, and educational materials. The provider database is organized by county, with a comprehensive list of all the mental health professionals in that area, so that people can choose to follow up with a local specialist. Project coordinator Bobby Lowe says they have also installed a phone in the screening kiosk that rings straight to the 24-hour Trillium helpline.
At that point, they're able to use the phone that is attached and contact our call center directly. They're able to take a card that has the information on it, and people can also email the results from the kiosk to themselves. And the email address is not stored, but the information is sent directly to them.
Setting up each of the kiosk stations with their privacy booths and the computer software cost about $5,000. The money for the first two kiosks came from a grant, but Trillium plans to launch four more screening kiosks in January with their own funds. Vice President Cindy Ellers says they are currently in discussions with other eastern North Carolina counties to determine the most appropriate locations.
We actually got a grant from the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services for the development of this kiosk. With our own funding, we're going to proceed with putting kiosks in even more communities. We would hope to eventually have a kiosk, at least one, in all 24 counties.
Since unveiling the mental health kiosks last month in Hyde and Dare counties, more than 141 screenings have been completed. Hyde County Public Health Department Director David Howard hopes the kiosks will push people to get preventative treatment early.
It is fantastic to have it out in the open. It helps to destigmatize the issues of behavioral health and to bring it on par with people freely talking about their physical health, dieting, exercising, etc. It just moves us a little further toward behavioral health issues becoming more of a normal conversation and concern.
The Access Point program offers self-conducted screenings for depression, bipolar disorder, post-traumatic stress, generalized anxiety, eating disorders, and alcohol abuse. The kiosks can move to other areas within the county on a rotating basis. For Public Radio East, this is Sarah Finch.
With the expansion of opportunities for women, the United States military is changing, and Marine Corps Base Camp Lejeune in Jacksonville has seen its share of that change. Recently, the base broke new ground yet again by promoting Lieutenant Colonel Lauren Edwards to a command position over the 8th Engineer Support Battalion, the first woman to command an engineering battalion in Marine Corps history. Chris Thomas has a profile on this Marine making history in eastern North Carolina.
When I was in Iraq in 2003, I remember going on convoy and there were little kids throwing flowers and giving thumbs up in our path or on the side of the road.
Lauren Edwards likes puzzles. She likes seeing fragments come together to create a whole, clear picture. Puzzles come in all shapes, sizes, and purposes, and Edwards describes her work as a puzzle of sorts. Only, instead of sitting on a living room floor with jigsaw pieces, she's coordinating the movements of material and manpower that help sustain the lives of Marines and sailors.
There are so many different pieces and parts that have to come together, and they have to come together at the right moment in time. But you can really solve a puzzle, and a lot of the stuff we do can really make a difference in the morale of the Marines in the field.
In September, Edwards was promoted to the rank of Lieutenant Colonel, and in a ceremony aboard Marine Corps Base Camp Lejeune last week, took command of the 8th Engineer Support Battalion, the first woman ever to do so. This will be her second time stationed on the base, and though she's breaking new ground, things feel quite familiar.
Camp Lejeune's a pretty amazing place. A lot of us start our specialty training down here. I started training down here at Courthouse Bay for combat engineering. So it's just good to be back to one of those places in the Marine Corps you can kind of call home.
Holding battalion colors on a parade field in eastern North Carolina is a long ways from the rolling hills of Kentucky, from which Edwards hails. Edwards grew up with two siblings and loving parents, which included many of her elders.
You know, everybody's looking out for everybody, and your parents were de facto parents for others, and that was just fine.
She's from Smith's Grove in Warren County, with a population of about 714. She remembers Marine recruiters' constant presence at her high school and their high rate of success, but tragedy led her to joining.
I had a cousin who was killed in a training accident, and his funeral, I saw the loyalty and camaraderie and respect and dignity that Marines gave.
Edwards also credits one of her civics teachers, Bill Utley, who reminded her and her classmates there is more to the world than Smith's Grove, and everyone in that room had a responsibility to it.
He really helped either foster that spark or facilitate that spark of love of nation and love of country and love of service.
Edwards would go to the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. on a track and field scholarship, with initial plans to go into sports broadcasting. But the USMC called to her, and after graduating, she went to Officers Candidate School, graduating and earning her gold bar as a second lieutenant in 1998. Edwards remembers her first day at OCS.
Honestly, it was a really slow day because I knew that we were going to have a day called pickup in a couple of days, and they were just going to yell and yell a lot and yell some more.
She started her career in engineering there, a field that can make or break success in a tight, dangerous situation like combat.
A lot of the stuff we do can really make a difference in the morale of the Marines in the field.
As they do in civilian life, engineers in the Marine Corps build, maintain, and repair roads and structures. Combat engineers, though, must also clear minefields and demolish the work of enemy engineers if the situation calls for it.
Generally, we do, you know, survivability, mobility, countermobility, and a lot of, you know, survivability, there's a lot of construction, horizontal, vertical construction of things. Mobility, you're looking at roads and airfields and being able to ensure that ground troops can travel and move throughout the battlefield. And then countermobility, obviously, is countering the enemy's movement.
There has been call for such action early and often over the past 14 years, after the September 11th attacks. Edwards had recently received and followed orders to go to the air station in Yuma, Arizona. But after word spread about the attack that Tuesday morning, she knew things had changed for good, though she wasn't sure how.
My unit, we weren't originally on the slate to go, but we got called up kind of as a last add-on. So a couple months later is when it really started happening for us, and then that's when that part of the reality came for me personally.
Edwards completed three tours throughout the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. One of the longest days in Edwards' career came in 2003, when she and more than 100 fellow Marines, sailors, and soldiers came under attack. In the book Why Marines Fight, she recalled the enemy's reluctance to face the grunts, a nickname given to infantry personnel in the Marine Corps, and opened fire on a convoy of engineers instead.
We were traveling back from Tikrit. We were going through Baghdad, and we just ended up hitting an ambush area and took a lot of fire.
She said it was the first time she'd faced gunfire and called it an out-of-body experience, in which time became irrelevant and only the safety of the people under her mattered. It was an experience for which she earned an award for valor and gave her a taste of combat leadership.
These are your Marines and sailors and soldiers in this case, and your responsibility is to them. So whatever it is you do, you are secondary as far as you yourself. It's all about the Marine, sailor, soldier, and your left or right, and that's everything.
The United States Marine Corps is an institution that prides itself on traditions. It's the way Marines link themselves to former, never ex, Marines, and those yet to don the dress blues. Yet Edwards takes a command post at Camp Lejeune, a base where the smallest, oldest branch of the Republic's military looks to the future. It's the location of Montford Point, where the first black Marines trained. It's the base where the Marines Women Reserve began, which blazed the trail for seven Marines who may be the first official female grunts. As Edwards looks back on a career that's approaching two full decades, she says one of her proudest accomplishments is one that has no direct connection with the Marine Corps, making the Warren County Schools Hall of Distinguished Alumni this year.
If you can leave your hometown but yet still remain tied to it, I think it's pretty important to pay it forward. And I think if that accolade just shows young men and women alike back home that they can do whatever they want, they can be whomever they want, I think that that's what we're all charged to do during our time here.
You can hear more from Edwards on our website, publicradioeast.org. I'm Chris Thomas.
This weekend, the Jennifer Leko Band will be performing two Celtic Christmas concerts with Irish fiddler Patrick Mangan. Mac McKee spoke with Jennifer and the band and has this.
The roots of a lot of American folk music come from the Celtic songs of Ireland and Scotland. When did you discover your musical heritage?
I think as a child it never fascinated me. It was just, I always sang what I loved to sing. But then after I graduated from college and I went to study in Scotland, I felt even more connected to the music, and I wasn't quite sure why. I couldn't really explain it. And I think the more that I learned about that, the more I realized there was a reason behind this natural feeling.
How long have you been performing the Celtic Christmas shows, and how did you come up with the idea for them?
So we started this particular Celtic Christmas concert tour 5 years ago, and it actually evolved from a Christmas concert that I did years before that, and that concert had a mixture of musicians and different styles, and we performed in it just three or four songs, and so many people commented how much they would love to have just a Celtic Christmas show. So eventually I got around to putting that together, and it's been going ever since.
You were born here in North Carolina. What is it like to be back during the holidays and being able to take a break?
Being back in North Carolina is great. It's nice to be here and to be by the coast. And, you know, living in Brazil now, and I've moved to 11 different states or countries over the past 16 years. So North Carolina is like my solid ground. They're my roots. So this is the place I always return to, and it's always there for me to keep me grounded and to provide me with lots of comfort. And the people, the traditions, the landscape, it's all made me who I am, and I'm really proud to call North Carolina my home.
Let's talk a little bit about your bandmates.
Yes, I will pass you over to Patrick Mangan, who is the fiddle player with the band.
You are one of the youngest performers of the Riverdance show, correct?
Well, I was, at least when I started. I've been with the show for many years now. I did it for the first time in 2001 when I was 16. So, it's been a while with the Riverdance.
How did you get involved in Celtic playing?
Well, I'm originally from Brooklyn, New York, and there's a really vibrant Irish community and Irish music community in particular. In New York City, a lot of great musicians, a lot of live music jam sessions around town. So I studied with a great fiddle player in New York called Brian Conway. I just took to it very quickly, I guess.
And how long have you been performing with Jennifer?
This is actually going to be our first tour together. I'm really excited to be down here. I can put Bob on, our piano player and musical director.
You have a very well-traveled and well-versed experience in the English music scene.
Well, yes, I have. More the late 70s, yeah. I was in a band called Omaha Sheriff. That album did very well. It was a national breakout in Billboard, and then Elvis Presley died, and RCA turned over the plant to printing Elvis's records, so it didn't get any further than that. But then I played with a lady called Judy Zook for many years and did lots of albums with her. And during that course of the time, I played with Dexys Midnight Runners and A-ha and a few other people. And then I met Jennifer later on. And we do this every year, and I look forward to it.
So how
and
does
it's great fun.
So how does studio work influence your work when you work with Jennifer?
I tend to do a lot of the arranging, and then because we're all in separate places, I'll send out backing tracks to Patrick and Patsy and Jennifer, and then I send it to Jennifer, and then Jennifer sings on it, and then she sends it back to me, and then we send it all over the place, and it's very confusing. So then we meet for about 3 days, and all of a sudden, it sounds great. It is sounding very good, I must say. We're very happy with the way it's going.
Patsy, how are you, sir?
I'm very well. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you. Now, you're from County Cork, Ireland, originally, right?
I am. Mm-hmm.
Now, were you always influenced by this music, or did were you a rock and roller and then kind of went back and forth to it?
How did you know? You've been reading my mail, because that's pretty much what happened. You know, as is true of a lot of guitar players, I got into guitar through blues and rock and roll and jazz and stuff like that. And it's as I got older, I started to soak up some of what was around me, immediately around me in my environs where I grew up, and that was some of the traditional Irish stuff.
So really, being able to play this kind of music and looking at your musical past, your roots are always there, and yet you're always being able to experiment.
That's kind of it. You know, you can always look around and do things, but you can always come home, you know. So it's the best of both worlds.
Star of wonder, star of night, star.
Public Radio East is a media sponsor for the Celtic Christmas Concert tonight at 7:30 p.m. at Oeringer Auditorium on the New Bern campus of Craven Community College. There's another performance tomorrow at 8 p.m. at the Turnage Theater in Washington. For more information, visit our website, publicradioeast.org. Thanks for listening to the Down East Journal. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, drop us a line at publicradioeast.org.